Hello, it's Tuesday the 13th of April and welcome to Korea 24. I'm your host, Kwon Jang-won. Japan has announced that it'll be releasing contaminated radioactive water from the stricken Fukushima nuclear power plant into the sea. South Korea has expressed strong concerns, but some expert opinion remains split. We'll have more in our news briefing and later we'll be speaking to two experts who are for and against the release. Then later for Touch Base in Seoul, we'll be connecting with a Grammy Award-winning musician. Korean-American violist Richard O'Neill will be joining us on the line. We have all that and more coming up on today's Korea 24. What you're hearing now are sounds from a protest held in Seoul immediately after Japan announced on Tuesday its plans to release the radioactive wastewater from its now-defunct Fukushima nuclear power plant into the Pacific Ocean. After years of floating the idea to the rest of the world, and despite protests from activists and neighboring countries, Japanese Prime Minister Yoshihide Suga unveiled its release schedule, which may begin in 2 years' time. Let's listen to that announcement.
How to take care of the treated water is an unavoidable obstacle in the process of the decommissioning of the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant. We will make sure to secure the safety level way over the benchmark, and the government will put all its effort into measures against the spread of unfounded harmful rumors. With such commitments, we judge that releasing the treated water into the sea is possible and came to an agreement on the basic measures.
Japan's immediate neighbors, South Korea and China, as well as international activists, slammed the decision, citing concerns about health issues and environmental pollution. Here to give us the details of Japan's announcement and its repercussions, as well as our other headlines of the day, is KBS World Radio news editor Ku Hee-jin. Hello, Hee-jin.
Hello, Chang-ho.
So Tokyo is pledging to reinforce monitoring of the entire process and ensure that its containment levels remain far below internationally accepted standards. How much of the water is in storage?
Well, according to the Tokyo Electric Power Company, as of March 18th, more than 1.25 million tons of that water is now stored in tanks at the plant, enough to fill the Tokyo Dome baseball stadium. It is running out of space as it has filled 91% of the capacity and expected to run out of that next year. The water must first go through an extensive filtration process known as the Advanced Liquid Processing System, or ALPS, that removes radioactive elements before disposal. As for tritium, an element that could lead to adverse health effects for humans but can't be removed through the ALPS, Tokyo plans to dilute the levels to 1/7 of the World Health Organization's drinking water standards. The release is set to start in 2 years after it builds the necessary facilities to install and conduct safety protocols. It will last 3 to 4 decades, ending somewhere between 2041 and 2051.
Now, Tokyo's decision brought swift reaction from Seoul and Beijing, with both governments lodging protests. Civic groups have also condemned the plans and called on Japan to reverse its decision. Can you tell us more?
Well, the South Korean government held a news conference expressing deep regret over its decision, of Japan's decision, and vowed to take all necessary steps to ensure the safety of the South Korean public. Let's listen to what South Korean Ku Yeon-char, Minister for the Office of Government Policy Coordination, said during a conference held on Tuesday.
The decision by the Japanese government can never be accepted. The release of contaminated water from the Fukushima nuclear plant will not only threaten the safety of neighboring countries and their marine ecology, but also was a decision made unilaterally without consent or sufficient consultation with its nearest neighbor, South Korea.
And as I mentioned, South Korea was not alone in denouncing Japan's plans, right?
Unfortunately not. South Korea called on Japan to ensure the transparent release of the information and verification of its water treatment process, and also plans to reinforce radioactive tests on imported food products and crackdowns on violations regarding the place of origin. South Korea's foreign ministry summoned Japanese ambassador to Seoul, Koichi Aiboshi, to lodge a formal complaint. In Beijing, China's foreign ministry strongly denounced Tokyo's decision, calling it irresponsible and unilateral. It said in a statement that the discharge will bring about serious damage to neighboring countries and made it clear that Japan must not release the water until an agreement is reached among nearby nations, as well as with the International Atomic Energy Agency. An alliance of South Korean anti-nuclear and environmental groups defined Japan's moves as an act of nuclear terror, urging Tokyo to immediately withdraw its plans. 31 groups, including Greenpeace, said on Tuesday that the release will have catastrophic consequences on humans and the marine ecosystem. Greenpeace International Executive Director Jennifer Morgan expressed outrage that Japan and the Tokyo Electric Power Company think they can justify the deliberate dumping of nuclear waste into the Pacific Ocean, saying that it is a violation of Japan's legal obligations under the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea. And these concerns echo that of the public, not just in South Korea, but also in Japan as well. According to a poll by Yomiuri Shimbun last month, only 2 out of 10 Japanese people surveyed supported the government's decision to release the water into the ocean. The rest were undecided or opposed the plans altogether.
And the same concerns were expressed by the public here in South Korea. Let's listen to what a seafood merchant, Yi Hae-ok, had to say regarding Japan's plans.
People buy our seafood products to eat, and some products they eat raw without cooking or processing. These raw products will become very dangerous as Japan dumps nuclear wastewater into the sea. Japan's decision hit us hard. Our business has already hit rock bottom due to the COVID-19 pandemic, and we are striving to survive every day, not to mention we are yet to take such a double whammy.
Yes, concerns there. We will be talking to two experts, though, who have differing thoughts on the safety of the release, and that is coming up in our in-depth analysis segment after this news briefing. Let's turn now to news on the pandemic. The number of new infections stayed in 500s for a second day here in South Korea as concerns linger of an acceleration, the spread of the virus. Can you give us the latest figures?
Oh, yes, the Korea Disease Control and Prevention Agency added 542 additional cases on Tuesday, bringing the country's cumulative total to 110,688. And again, the bulk of the new infections came from the greater metro area, with 156 in Seoul, 163 in the Gyeonggi province, and 16 in Incheon. What is of more concern is the nation's COVID-19 reproduction rate, which stood at 1.12 for the past week, raising concerns of further spread of the virus. The rate refers to the number of infections caused by a single patient, and a figure over one means the virus is spreading. It is the second week in a row the number remained higher than one nationwide, following 1.07 a week earlier. Meanwhile, Seoul Mayor Oh Se-hoon attended a cabinet meeting on Tuesday where he proposed the introduction of rapid COVID-19 diagnostic kits. He did not elaborate on the response from the ministers of health and food and drug safety when they received his suggestions. Oh took office less than a week ago after winning a by-election, made his proposal to introduce a Seoul-type social distancing in which customers could use these kits before entering nightlife establishments. The kits usually yield results in 10 to 20 minutes. This would alleviate some of the financial burden of owners and businesses such as restaurants, bars and karaoke's who currently have to close their establishments at 10 p.m., All's proposal to introduce these kits and lift restrictions on business hours is facing opposition from medical experts, the ruling party and the central government, who question the reliability of the kits.
Let's turn now to the world of technology, where President Joe Biden said on Monday that the US needs to make an act investment in the chip industry amid a global shortage of semiconductors and step up its game to stay ahead of global competitors. Can you tell us more?
Yes, of course. Biden held a video conference with 19 executives from the technology, chip and auto industries, including Samsung Electronics and Intel. He said that the US needs to build a new chip infrastructure, one that would include semiconductors, wafers, batteries and broadband. The US needs to build an infrastructure of today, not repair the one of yesterday, he said. In the virtual meeting, Biden said China and the rest of the world are not waiting, and there's no reason why Americans should wait. The White House arranged the meeting to address the global chip shortage that has impacted key industries such as auto manufacturing, a cornerstone of the US manufacturing industry.
That is where we'll leave it for our news briefing. Thank you for those updates, Heejin.
Thank you.
Ten years on from the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant disaster, Japan has made the controversial decision to release over a million tons of contaminated water produced from the accident into the sea. Tokyo has assured that the process will be carried out over decades, with the water adequately treated and diluted to safe levels. Well, the plan has been approved by the International Atomic Energy Agency. Environmental and fishing groups, as well as neighbouring countries, have all expressed concern, and in expert circles, opinion is split on whether this is the best course of action. To represent either side of that spectrum today, we have two back-to-back interviews lined up. First, we have joining us on the line now Dr. Kang Gonuk from the Department of Nuclear Medicine at Seoul National University Hospital. Thank you for your time today.
Oh, okay. Hello.
So, Doctor, Japan is set to release over a million tons of contaminated water into the sea beginning in 2 years' time. Tokyo says the water has been treated thoroughly through an extensive pumping and filtration system known as ALPS, or Advanced Liquid Processing System. But one particular radioactive isotope it cannot remove is tritium, which is causing much of the current concern. Dr. Kang, what is tritium first, and what kind of risks does tritium pose to marine life and human health?
You know, tritium is a radionuclide of hydrogen. You know, so hydrogen is the most abundant in atom of the water, and so mainly form of the tritium is a water and tritiate water, and tritiate water is mainly and come from the natural source. And especially and the solar energy produced in the tritium at the atmosphere and every day. And so it is observed in the ocean water. And so ocean water also has a tritium, or also every drinking water has a small amount of tritium and tritiate water. And the tritium is emit a low energy beta ray. Maybe it causes some problem, but it is much lower than the other and the radioactive materials such as the cesium, and almost 600 times and lower effect than in the cesium in our body.
Okay, so tritium is everywhere, even in drinking water, as you're saying. But I understand in high doses, it can be dangerous to humans.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it is very occasionally occurs in the we have some case report in the 1950s, and at the time in the Soviet Union, there has some kind of experiment, and the really high amount of tritium is the researchers and aided and the death from the tritium. It is a really high amount.
Right. So currently, if the water at the Fukushima nuclear power plant was, say, not to be treated, it would be at a level that is dangerous. Correct?
No, it is a dangerous, and that it is a in drinking enough water, but even in the small amount of the water is not so dangerous, even in that concentration. Yeah.
Okay. The IAEA seems to have strongly backed this as well, saying that nuclear power plants around the world use a similar process to dispose of wastewater. Mm-hmm. However, environmental and other civic groups stress that this can still be dangerous, releasing this radioactive material, and it could become concentrated in the food chain. What do you make of their concerns?
Yeah, there. If it is released into the Pacific Ocean is so vast, and there it is a trillion times much larger than the Tricia waters. It is mixed with that and diluted it, and so the oceans and just around in the 0.1 or 0.2 back rate per liter. But if you mixed with it in the trillion times, and you cannot measure it at all. And so there is almost no danger because tritium is still exists in the ocean a large amount, but it is mixed with it, and so you cannot find it out at all.
Mm. Prime Minister Yoshihide Suga has called the release this the most realistic option. Are there not any other alternatives? Is there no other way to more effectively treat and filter the water so that it does remove more tritium, so that it allays people's concerns?
Tritium water is a kind of water, and it is very difficult to separate it from just the water. And so that's why they have to releasing it. If there isn't some other measures, and this is just a kind of increase the water tank. And so it means that it covers a lot of space in the nearby areas. And the main problem is that there is some collecting waters there and the still radioactive is high concentrated. It is more dangerous to the human. It is released into the ocean. It is diluted, and so it is almost disappeared. Yeah.
Aside from tritium, could there be any other radioactive isotopes in the contaminated water that could be of concern?
Yeah, maybe a C-14 or some other cesiums and strontiums. A small amount is still there, and so it is released into the ocean. It is the same phenomenon that occurs, and it is diluted. And some strontium is somewhat heavier than the other materials, and it is going into the basement and the bottom of as a sediment, and so it is not accumulating into our systems, our body, and no problem at all.
Is there anything that we need to be watching out for? We need to be careful.
Yeah, we can measuring. We can measure the sea water and check the monitors. And is there any increase of the amount of the radioactive materials? And the Fukushima accident, after just in the 1 or 2 years, it released a so vast amount of the radioactive material into the ocean, but we cannot measure that because it is diluted. But nowadays, contaminated water is much less than that before, just after Fukushima. Yeah. Mm.
And so you're saying, for now, this does seem to be the most realistic option, you're saying?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. We will leave it there. We've been speaking to Dr. Kang Gonuk from the Department of Nuclear Medicine at Seoul National University Hospital. Thank you for your time once again today.
Yeah, thank you. Bye-bye.
Now let's speak to an expert who we understand does have reservations and concerns about Tokyo's plan that was announced. We have joining us on the line now Professor Seo-Gyun Ryo from Seoul National University's Department of Nuclear Engineering. Welcome to the show, Professor.
Hello there. Thanks for having me.
So, Professor, what did you make of Tokyo's announcement today that it was going to be releasing contaminated water from the Fukushima nuclear power plant into the sea?
It actually sounded outrageous to me in the sense that they are actually talking about all those kinds of radioactive species, which includes but not limited to tritium, plutonium, strontium, and basically cesium. They are pretty much radioactive materials, and I don't think they've got rid of them all, in fact. So that means they still have a lot of it in their storage tanks at the moment. It's not time yet to release the radioactive water to anywhere, for that matter.
Professor, we just spoke to a doctor who said that the radiation levels in the contaminated water at Fukushima are not of a concerning level, and that even if tritium, which is cannot be treated, that is diluted enough for the water to be safely released into the water. The International Atomic Energy Agency has also said that nuclear plants around the world use a similar process to dispose of wastewater. Right. What do you make of those comments?
First of all, actually, I'm not really giving a lot of weight to what the kind of statement that actually Japanese government and TEPCO has must have said about this, because they've been actually hiding this fact of coal meltdown for 10 weeks. Now they're doing it for radioactive materials, because they've been hiding this fact for almost 10 years. Now they're saying that they've done their homework. They got rid of all those radioactive materials. I don't count on their saying, because it's just too much. We're talking about 1.25 million tons of radioactive water. Is huge. It is tantamount to approximately 600 Olympic-sized swimming pools. It's just too much. There is no way of getting rid of all those probably 200-plus radioactive species at one time. I believe they would need at least one more decade to get rid of all those remaining radioactive species. So I'm not really trusting what they're talking about, their remaining radioactive material. I think that's the bottom line, as far as I'm concerned.
Right, so you have doubts about Tokyo's statements saying that they have successfully treated. But if they were to be successfully treated, you would say that it could be safe one day to release the water into the sea?
Probably one of these days. And also at the time, I don't think any country has any right to be able to release radioactive water to the Pacific Ocean, because Pacific Ocean belongs to the world, not to Japan. Think about Three Mile Island Unit 2. They took care of it within the United States soil. When it comes to Chernobyl, they took care of it on the Ukrainian soil. What kind of logic is it that Japan is going to trash it into the Pacific? It doesn't make sense. So first of all, clarified actually, and then purified, and then use their own land to be able to get rid of those radioactive material, not the Pacific Ocean. No way.
Some say that the Pacific Ocean is vast enough that the contaminated water will be diluted enough, and that the radioactive material will spread enough into the sea, and that it won't be of concern. What concerns could there be that you are saying that we should be watching out for? I understand environmental and other civic groups have stressed that if this radioactive material is released into the sea, it could become concentrated in the food chain.
Right. First of all, the food chain, because actually we might be talking of crustaceans, and also some kind of little fish, which might get eaten by bigger fish, and all the way to probably tunas. Now the problem is that we are not quite sure what kind of tuna that is going to be, because it might be or must be swimming somewhere very far from the Japanese coast. We don't know where they might be located. And I am agreed. I buy the idea that it is going to be diluted, yes. But as far as the numerator is one, that one might be you, might be me, might be us. It's just a matter of probability. So we can never, ever stress the importance of keeping this radioactive material away from us. And so once it is released, then it just goes anywhere. It just goes out of control. So we are going to stop it no matter what. That's my message.
Right, so you're saying we have to remain on a high alert because of how dangerous this material could potentially be. So what could the international community be doing now to ensure that the situation is safe? What would you like to see happen?
Now it's been almost 10 years. At the least amount, they must be waiting 10 more years to go. Then the kinds of radioactive materials, which might include cesium, iodine, strontium, tritium, might be coming down to an acceptable level. And until actually even then, the Japanese government is not allowed to release it to the Pacific Ocean. It belongs to everybody. You, me, everybody, not to Japanese people, not to Japan, not to Japanese government. So what they're going to do is to get rid of all those materials using their own territory. For example, they can actually buy some land around the Fukushima Daiichi plant area. They can just have an access to those areas, and then they can just come up with some kind of a reservoir which can possibly contain probably 2.5 million tons. That should be more than enough, which can take up at the least 20 years of release. So they can do that. They don't need to go out to the sea. That's an open sea. It's everybody's. I don't think that belongs to Japan.
Right. Tokyo Electric Power, or TEPCO, have constructed 1,000 tanks next to the site. But they're saying space is running out by the second half of 2022. But you're saying they should be making more tanks then?
Exactly. And then also they need to be basically trying to build some more reservoir, for example, which can take up probably as twice as much. Why are they really struggling with all those tanks? They can just come up with some kind of artificial lake, for example. They can just pour in the water. And if it's clean up, then they can just use it for somewhere else, for somebody else or for some other purposes. They are not going to release it, any single drop of it. They can just do it within their territory. That's my message. It's not going to actually go above the, or beyond the boundary of their own nation.
Professor Seo, we appreciate your thoughts on this matter today. We've been speaking to Professor Seo Geun-ryul from Seoul National University's Department of Nuclear Engineering. Thank you once again for your time.
My pleasure.
Welcome to the Korea 24 Stock and Forex Update. The benchmark Korea Composite Stock Price Index rose 33.49 points, or 1.07% on Tuesday, to close at 3,169.08. The tech-heavy KOSDAQ also rose, gaining 9.72 points, or 0.97%, to close at 1,010.37. On the foreign exchange, the local currency weakened 1 won against the dollar, ending the session at 1,125.9 won. You can check Korean stock and forex closings at world.kbs.co.kr.
We continue on now to our daily segment, Korea Trending. For this part of the show, we take a look at some of the other news stories that have been looked up by many here in South Korea Online. And these stories have been handpicked by our Korea 24 team. Bringing us those stories today is our contributor, Lee Ju-young, who joins us on the line now. Hello, Ju-young.
Hello, Jung-ho.
So what are the stories that you have for us today?
Our first story is about new revelations from inspections on Korean restaurants regarding imported kimchi and the government's efforts to quell consumer anxiety. We then talk about Korean social network service Cyworld and how its users may potentially be able to use the platform's digital currency to make in-game purchases on a major game company. Our last story is about K-pop girl group Blackpink, who has garnered over 60 million YouTube subscribers this morning.
Okay, let's get started on our first story then, and it's about the Korean staple kimchi. Can you tell us more?
Sure. Many restaurants across South Korea have been caught falsely labeling kimchi made in China as made in Korea. According to the National Agricultural Products Quality Management Service yesterday, an emergency inspection of 3,000 restaurants nationwide from March 22nd to the 28th found that 130 restaurants falsely marked the origin of their kimchi.
Okay, so falsely labeled the kimchi then. What prompted these inspections by the government?
Around a month ago, a video went viral that showed a Chinese man handling kimchi in an unsanitary environment, raising consumer anxiety. And back then, the Ministry of Food and Drug Safety said that the cabbages in the video reportedly shot in China were not for export purposes and that imported kimchi are thoroughly inspected during the customs clearance and distribution stages. However, public distrust is still high, especially considering Korea's dependence on Chinese kimchi. And according to the Korea Rural Economic Institute, Korea's import dependence on Chinese kimchi is very big, with 54% of Seoul's restaurants saying that they use imported kimchi. In fact, more than 100 kimchi manufacturers in China reportedly export about 80% of their production to Korea, with exports having exceeded 300,000 tons in 2019. Imported Chinese kimchi is about 2 to 3 times cheaper than kimchi made in Korea, making it hard to find a good replacement.
Right. So did the government talk then about how they're going to deal with this issue and quell consumer anxiety?
Yes. They said that they will introduce the food safety management system, HACCP, on imported food starting from July this year to ensure the safety of imported kimchi from China. The HACCP stands for the Hazard Analysis Critical Control Point, run by the United States Food and Drug Administration. However, discussions are reportedly being stalled. The food ministry also said that they have asked Chinese manufacturers to be more thorough in managing sanitation in their workplace environments and manufacturing facilities.
Yes, that video you talked about earlier that went viral really horrified viewers in Korea. Hopefully more can be done to make sure that Korean kimchi is marked Korean kimchi, and even if it is Chinese, that it does meet all health and safety standards as well.
Exactly.
Let's move on to our second story now. What do you have for us?
Our show previously talked about PsyWorld, a Korean social network service that enjoyed immense popularity in the early 2000s, being revived in March. Well, PsyWorld's homepage officially relaunched last week, and with that, PsyWorld users may have the ability to transfer the platform's digital currency known as Acorns into usable gaming currency for one of the three major game companies in Korea, Nexon, NCSoft, or Netmarble. And I use the word may because talks of such a deal are still in the works. On PsyWorld, these acorns are used to decorate homepages, purchase characters, speech bubbles, background music, fonts, and more.
Right. So before, when these acorns, they could be bought with money. So when the site was originally shutting down, there were question marks about how people might be compensated as they had a monetary value. And it looks like that digital currency could now be used with these other gaming companies. How would that work exactly?
So PsyWorld Z, which is the new owner of PsyWorld, and we'll get into that later, said last month that once the service fully relaunches, it planned to refund about 3.5 billion won worth of acorns that users had previously bought. But if partnerships were to be established, then users can choose to either get their acorns refunded or use them to make in-game purchases from the companies I mentioned earlier.
I see. Now, we have talked about PsyWorld's death and revival previously, but for those unfamiliar, can you fill us in?
Sure. PsyWorld Z was formed after a consortium of five local entertainment companies acquired the rights to PsyWorld back in February. Former PsyWorld CEO Chun Jae-won reportedly received 1 billion won for handing over the business in January after he was previously indicted on charges of failing to pay the same amount to former employees. The service recovery is expected to bring back the data of some 32 million users, which include 17 billion photos and 150 million video files.
Right. PsyWorld was the social media platform for the early 2000s in Korea. So people have a lot of photos and memories on there still. But it looks like they will still be remaining, and so could the acorns as well, it seems. Let's move on to our last story of the day now. What do you have for us?
K-pop superstar girl group Blackpink surpassed the 60 million subscriber mark on YouTube as of 6 a.m. this morning. They are the first female act in the world to achieve this milestone. And with that, the four-member group's YouTube channel is now the biggest account in South Korea and the second largest among global artists, only behind Justin Bieber, who has over 62 million subscribers. Blackpink had already surpassed Ariana Grande in July last year, who once had the largest number of subscribers at a female artist. Since then, their channel steadily surpassed artists like Eminem, Ed Sheeran, and Marshmello.
Wow, that is very impressive. Can you tell us in a bit more detail about how Blackpink amassed such a huge fan base on YouTube?
Sure. Blackpink's subscriber count grew steadily since their debut in 2016, but it skyrocketed since the pre-release of their music video, How You Like That, in June last year. Their agency, YG Entertainment, said that while it took Bieber about 11 years to amass over 60 million subscribers, Blackpink subscribers, on the other hand, are increasing at an overwhelming rate, and added that the top spot has come into view.
So over 60 million subscribers. That must mean their channel is very busy then.
Absolutely. Blackpink's YouTube channel garnered more than 17 billion cumulative views. The group's most watched videos include the 2018 release Do-Do-Do-Do at 1.5 billion views and its 2019 hit Kill This Love with 1.2 billion.
Right, and just for reference, those two music videos have more views than any of BTS's music videos as well. That is where we'll leave it for today's Korea Trending. Thank you for bringing us those stories, Chuyoung, and we'll talk to you again next time.
Thank you, Jang-ho.
K-pop megagroup BTS might not have won a highly coveted Grammy Award last month, but Korea still had cause to celebrate because Korean-American violist Richard Yongje O'Neill did. He won the Grammy Award's Best Classical Instrumental Solo for his performance of the Theophanidis Concerto for Viola and Chamber Orchestra. This world-renowned violist, now based in Boulder, Colorado, has been making waves in the classical world for over a decade now, especially in Korea, with his frequent media appearances, successful albums and performances. And I'm delighted to say that he joins us on the show now via video link for this week's Touch Base in Seoul. Mr. O'Neill, thank you for being on the show today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, first, I'd like to give our wholehearted congratulations to you on your Grammy win. It's an amazing achievement. This was, in fact, the third time, I understand, that you had been nominated, but obviously the first time you'd won. Tell us, what was it like when your name was called out this time?
It was just beyond words. I was so incredibly happy and thrilled. I think you never really understand how much it means to win something until you've lost, you know. And as you've mentioned, you know, I was nominated. My first nomination was 15, 16 years ago. You know, I was a younger man, and then 10 years ago. So to get this nomination now in my life, as well as during this incredibly challenging period of this pandemic, which has now been plaguing the world for over a year, it just meant it amplified, it augmented the experience tremendously.
Right. During your acceptance speech, you said it was a great day for the viola. I understand it's only the second time a violist has won this category. What does it mean for a violist to win a Grammy?
You know, the Grammys, for all the criticism and controversy that the Grammys cause every year, not just in the classical world, in the pop world, the Grammys truly are one of the most enigmatic awards because it's a peer based award. You're nominated by your peers, meaning all of the professionals in the industry, not just musicians like myself, but composers, sound engineers, publicists, record producers, everyone involved in the Academy. It's a very broad community. So the nomination itself is a tremendous honor. To make the shortlist is really incredibly meaningful. And winning the award is equally meaningful because winning a majority of the votes among the shortlist is really, really challenging. Mm. And this is not a popularity contest in the sense that, you know, it's not a public choice award, you know, like the People's Choice Award. This is not somebody calling in and voting. This is you're the very most powerful people in the music industry in the United States voting. Mm. So for to choose a violist among three of my favorite world-class pianists, Danil Trifonov, Igor Levit, and Kirill Gerstein, and my favorite violinist, Augustin Haderlich, and three of the world's greatest orchestra, the Bayerischen Rundfunk, the Boston Symphony, the Philadelphia Orchestra. Mm. That's a tremendous list of people. I mean, that's a who's who of everyone that's in the world that's working today. So it was a huge shock for me that people chose me.
Well, you have an incredible CV. You are the first violist to receive the artist diploma from Juilliard, an Avery Fisher Career Grant recipient, multiple platinum albums, concerto performances with the best orchestras like the London Philharmonic, the Los Angeles Philharmonic, and now you're a Grammy Award winner. What do you owe your success to?
I view my success in life, not just music, but in general, my survival, as sort of an improbable situation. Mm. I didn't set out my life to become famous or to be a soloist or a Grammy Award winner or any of those prizes that I dearly cherish, but the truth of the matter is I love music more than anything. And I committed early on in my life, as a young man growing up in a very small rural community with very little opportunity and very little means. But I made a promise to myself as a young man, as a boy, that if I became a musician, whatever that may be, sitting in the back of an orchestra, teaching, you know, you name it, I'd be happy, you know, and I've lived my life on that principle completely. And luckily, I think life has rewarded me for that dedication. And honestly, it was a lot of sacrifice and a lot of failures and a lot of risk taking. I think that's the hard thing. You know, a lot of artists, so many people are so deserving and there's so few positions available. And I consider myself lucky every day to do what I do, because it is a privilege. It's a tremendous privilege. And for a violist, in particular, violists, there's a wide perception in the world community that viola is an inferior instrument. It's not deserving of solo time. Mm. And for the Academy to give not only me, but all violists this hope that, hey, actually, people that really matter believe in the viola as a solo vehicle, not only makes it great for all violists, but I think it justifies my lifelong sort of passion to try to just do the best I can every day.
What is it about the viola that's special to you? I understand you started with a violin at the age of 5, but then you picked up the viola a bit later. What spoke to you about the viola?
Viola is, and some people call it, an imperfect instrument. Physics-wise, it's too small for the range it's been assigned. And because of that, the sound is very unique. Some describe it as a dark red wine, or a purple color, or a mellow, or somber, or foggy. I always have thought of it as sort of more like, it sort of lies in the low woman's voice range, almost like an alto voice. So to me, it's a very human range. And because I think of that register and its sort of uniqueness of sound, it's almost to me like an actor. It's given this very blank canvas of possibilities. And on that canvas, you can paint whatever you want, because there hasn't been the tradition in history like there has on the violin. Mm. You know, violin, there's been, for all the great violinists in the world today, there have been so many hundreds of great violinists that have lived before them. And there's this huge tradition and pressure for them to either conform to the tradition of what came before them or really break out and do something new. And I think with violists, it's a new world, and it's a new territory. And I find that very liberating, that I can walk out on stage and a lot of people will have never heard what I'm about to play. And I find that very freeing, and it gives me a sense that I can... It's a great responsibility for me to recreate the music in a very utmost of integrity, but also that I can... I don't have precedent. This is sort of new ground.
I think anyone who watches your performances will be moved by what you do and the range of sounds and emotion that you do bring. There's something that we haven't really heard a lot, as you've said, and it is very unique. It's got a very rich and dark colour to it, which I think you bring out wonderfully in your performances. As you mentioned, it wasn't an easy road that was paved for you, and part of your journey was charted in a 2004 KBS TV documentary series called Human Theatre, Ingang Geukjang, and that charted your musical career as well as your mother's search for her birth family. That was a huge hit, and you were invited for a second series as well, and that really put you on the map for Korean audiences here. How did that happen, and what impact did that have on your life?
You know, I was born here in the United States, yet the complicated thing about being American, if I might put it, is that even though I was born in this country, I was raised in this country, many of my family that I loved died in this country. And fought for this country, my grandfather in World War II. Yet, I've always felt like an outsider, treated by other Americans as a perpetual foreigner, because they just take one look at my face and they judge me. And that was really hard. And it caused a lot of pain early in life as a child growing up. When I came to Korea in my early 20s for concerts with the great Kyung Young-wha, the world famous violinist and dear mentor, I was so struck that first of all I landed in Korea, and if I didn't open my mouth, I fit right in. You know, nobody looked at me or called me names or treated me any differently. They just assumed I was one of them. And not to oversimplify, but as my search for my blood family, for my mother who's handicapped and cannot look for herself, continued, I was embraced and accepted and held up by so many Koreans. You know, my mom's handicapped, and a lot of handicapped people in the world are discriminated against every day. They can't get work, and people call them all sorts of names, and they're marginalized. But the Korean public was so kind to my mother, and that meant everything to me. And I was for the first time in my life, I felt like I was given another blank canvas of this love and support by so many people. And so that appearance on in Gangjeong, my mother and I failed in finding blood family, but we realized it's through that program that we inherited so many brothers and sisters in Korea that we had no idea that accepted us as their own.
Yes, it was a very moving series, and a lot of people here in Korea was very touched by it, and especially all the work that you put into your career as well. And we don't have time to go through all that you've achieved in your very vast, extensive musical career. But one thing I do want to mention is in your Grammy acceptance speech, again, you gave your eternal thanks to your family as well as the Takash Quartet and CU Boulder for keeping me alive. That's what you said. What did you mean by that? And can you tell us briefly about what it means to be part of this renowned Takash Quartet?
I really meant, I'm a very literal person, and I meant that literally. This last year has been, for musicians, at least for myself, and I would say many musicians across the world, it's been devastating seeing all of our work and our what we live for, to play for people, taken away and all, of course, in the interest of public safety. I first and foremost, I want people to be safe and healthy. But for a musician that dedicates their whole life to the phrase, the show must go on, and then all of a sudden that's broken, that trust, you know, I think if you ask any artist, fulfilling that promise of the show must go on is a very difficult one. Mm. It's your mother could be dying, and you're still expected to go up on stage like any professional and deliver music. Because I'm sure people feel badly for anyone that's suffering, but that's not what people, when they come to your concerts, they trust that you're going to bring them music no matter what. Mm. And that's my professional duty to bring music to people, because I never know who's in my audience. It could be Carnegie Hall. It could be in my, you know, a small house concert here in Boulder. I'll still do my very best because it means everything, that moment. And I might just add, you know, this has been a very, very, very sad time here in Colorado and Boulder, because we had a very terrible tragedy, a mass shooting a few weeks ago.
Sure, of course.
And 10 people were killed in the middle of the day, just trying to do their normal life, including a police officer. And I was asked by the police officer's family to play for his burial. And in moments of tragedy, in moments of triumph, in moments, the greatest moments, the most simple moments, I think music is there for everybody, because it's such a powerful language. And I feel like the responsibility to bring music to people is something I'll do till I die, unless it's taken away from me. And you know, we're reminded every day of, you know, you mentioned in Ganggukjang. I think the reason why in Ganggukjang is so powerful is because everyone has a story.
Mm.
Everyone.
Mm.
You just have to sit somebody down, anyone, and ask them if they really opened up. They would tell you things that would really make you wonder, wow, there's heroism everywhere in everyone's life. They might not make it to television. They might not make it to the stage, but I really truly believe that there's so much daily heroism that goes on in the world, and I think music embodies that. It's a universal language that connects, you know, people of different cultures, different languages, you know, different backgrounds. It's so magical.
I really wish we could talk more, but unfortunately, we are almost out of time. Very, very briefly, though, what do you have next? What plans do you have that you can share with us?
The Takash Quartet, which I said kept me alive. We literally they're part of my family. Mm. Through this whole time of no concerts, we've been rehearsing very, very hard, and we have a European tour coming up to Madrid, Luxembourg, and the Musikverein in Vienna. So I'm pleased, all of your listeners and you, please cross your fingers that there won't be any more lockdowns in Europe.
Sure.
But you know, the Musikverein is a temple of music, so I'm looking forward to that trip very much.
Yes, and I'm sure our listeners here in Korea cannot wait to see you back in Korea sometime soon as well, once the pandemic is over, to celebrate your Grammy win with you. Congratulations to you once again. We've been speaking to Grammy Award-winning violist Richard Yongjae O'Neill. We very much appreciate your time today.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure.
This is Scott Kelly, former NASA astronaut, and you're listening to Korea 24.
Welcome back. We finish up with a morning edition preview, our daily segment where we take a look at some stories coming out in tomorrow's newspapers. Joining me in the studio now for that is our staff editor, Mark Wilson. Chair Mark, it's great to see you.
Good to see you too.
So where are we headed to first?
That would be the People's section of the Korea Times, as Park Ji-won writes about the Ministry of Culture, Sports and Tourism awarding certificates of appreciation for promoting Korean traditional hanbok attire. The award ceremony was held at the Dongdaemun Design Plaza in Seoul on Monday, and it was in collaboration with the Hanbok Advancement Center.
So awards for promoting Korean traditional hanbok attire then.
That's right.
Who were some of the people recognized for promoting this?
Well, there was K-pop singer and actress Jun Hyo-sung, graffiti artist Chris Chan-young Shim, and even the costume designers for the historical zombie horror hit series Kingdom. But one name Park really featured, who couldn't be in attendance, understandably so, was U.S. Congresswoman Marilyn Strickland. Some listeners may remember that Strickland, one of the first Korean-American women elected to Congress, wore a hanbok during her swearing-in ceremony in January. Congresswoman Strickland went on to promote her Korean and African-American heritage online, and even hashtagging the word hanbok. I just covered a few of the names awarded at the ceremony, so just to learn more about them, pick up tomorrow's Times.
Let's move on to our second story now. What do you have for us?
Jo Hae-nim writes about a local outdoors clothing store teaming up with the Gangbuk-gu office in Seoul to offer a free rental service to use hiking shoes for foreigners. Clothing retailer Black Yak opened its rental station near Bukhansan Ui subway station. That's a pretty good location to offer hiking shoe rentals, considering Bukhansan is a well-known and challenging, I've hiked it, very difficult, mountain to hike, located on the northern periphery of Seoul.
Okay, for free rental service for hiking shoes for foreigners, how does this service work then exactly?
So people can pick out a size and color of the shoe they want to rent ahead of time through an online booking system, and then pick them up at the rental station. Gangbuk-gu office will be in charge of cleaning and sterilization, so they'll be all bright and shiny when you arrive, primed to take a hike.
Sure, I've tried Bukhansan as well. It's not the most challenging, but it
maybe
is...
Maybe we've gone different trails, Jang-ho. I don't know.
Sure, fair enough. But it is, I guess, best to be safe. These shoes do offer ankle support, and you don't want to hurt yourself as you're going up.
That's right.
That is where we'll leave it for Morning Edition Preview. Thank you for bringing us the stories, Mark, and we'll talk to you again next time.
Thanks so much.
And that is where we wrap up our show today. Join us again tomorrow for more news, views and reviews from Korea. And to sign off today, we'll be playing out with a song recorded by our Touch Base in Seoul guest, Richard O'Neill, called Somjip Agi on his album Lacrimae. Thank you for staying with us. I've been your host, Kwon Jang-ho. Until next time, goodbye.
Back to heaven by Chun Sang-byung.
나 하늘로 돌아가리라. 새벽빛 와 닿으면 쓰러지는 이슬 더불어 손에 손을 잡고.
I'll go back to heaven again, hand in hand with the dew that melts at a touch of the dawning day.
나 하늘로 돌아가리라. 노을빛 함께 단 둘이서 기슭에서 놀다가 구름 손짓하면은.
I'll go back to heaven again with the dusk together just we two at a sign from a cloud after playing on the slopes.
나 하늘로 돌아가리라. 아름다운 이 세상 소풍 끝내는 날 가서 아름다웠더라고 말하리라.
I'll go back to heaven again at the end of my outing to this beautiful world. I'll go back and say that was beautiful.
You've listened to Korean poet Chun Sang-byung's Gui Chan, Back to Heaven, read by An Jae-woo and translated by Brother Anthony of Tays and Sun Jae. KBS World Radio brings the beauty of Korean poetry to the world.